Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the second day of the July meeting of the iForest Interpretations Committee. Having made good progress yesterday, we can move to the first item on the agenda for this morning, which is agenda paper 11, suggestion that we take something on to the annual improvements cycle, dealing with iForest 8 operating segments. And Denise is ready to present to us.
Hello, good morning, everybody. We received, the board received a request to make some minor improvements to IFRS 8 operating segments with regard to the application of the aggregation criteria and the identification of the chief operating decision maker. First of all, the submitter asked to include an additional disclosure in paragraph 22 of IFRS 8 requiring a brief description of both the operating segments that have been aggregated and the economic indicators that have been assessed to conclude that operating segments have got similar economic characteristics in accordance with paragraph 12 of IFRS 8. We did our analysis and we thought that it would be a good idea to amend paragraph 22 in IFRS 8 by adding, as they suggested, subparagraph 22C, to require a little bit more specifically a disclosure on the application of the aggregation criteria, because we think that this disclosure is not specific enough in this paragraph. So what do you think about adding this disclosure?
Any comments? Criticisms, expressions of joy and happiness. John?
I don't understand the logic as to why we think this additional disclosure is necessary. Yes, it is not specifically required, but why would you think we need to require it? I mean, I would argue that we have a disclosure overload anyway. Why are we looking for this additional disclosure? I can't see any, quite frankly, justifiable rationale for saying that we need to do this, and that the reason that is actually put in here for doing it is to determine whether an entity has made an appropriate assessment of the aggregation criteria. But that's not what the role of financial statements are, is to enable users to determine whether the preparer has made an appropriate assessment. So basically I'm saying I don't see any rationale, and quite frankly I don't agree with making it.
Do you think that there is an issue here at all, or should we dismiss that? You don't think there's a problem? Okay. Ruth?
Yeah, I agree with Joanna. I don't see that there's a problem. I think there may be an element of mistrust of what management has done. That's indicated in the submission. Fair enough. But IFRS 8 is a standard that asks for management to use its judgment in a whole lot of things, including the identification of segments. So, and I agree with Joanna. I think putting in yet another disclosure is... in this particular case, is not warranted. So I don't support the adjustment.
Charlotte?
I would agree with others have said that I think it seems quite an extreme move, in particular in terms of, not so much just in terms of putting more of a brief description, but in terms of adding the measurement range, seems to be quite a step change in what the disclosures have at the moment.
Peggy?
Yes, I hadn't talked to Denise about this earlier. I've never seen it where you have a company that has six business units where they have less than six reportable segments in their disclosures. In fact, I was giving her examples of companies I'm familiar with that have, you know, six business units that have 120 and 143, you know, reportable segments. I don't see the need for it. I didn't see the need for additional disclosure.
Laurence?
Same comment.
It's getting a little repetitive, isn't it?
Sorry?
Carry on.
No, I just have the same comment as those that have been expressed, so I'm not going to take longer.
Okay, does anybody want to make a different comment? Rely on Andrew.
Well, I don't feel that strongly about it, but I do think some of the disclosure around how people have identified segments is sometimes not perfect, and I assume that this is aimed at trying to bring greater clarity into that disclosure, but I don't feel overly strongly about it.
Okay. Patrick?
Thank you. Good morning. Well, it is our view as enforcers of IFRS that disclosures would really improve the quality of the financial statement on this aspect, because we often see situations where issuers aggregate operating segments, and the way aggregation is performed raises questions, to say the least. And therefore, our view is that it would really be helpful to understand what are the criteria, what is the rationale behind the decision to present the reported segments.
Okay. Scott?
My view after reading everything was the same as others have expressed, that I don't see a strong case for adding this disclosure. If this request is coming from a user group or, I now guess, regulators perhaps, then maybe there's more to hear, but I don't think there's enough here for us to make the call that that we need this disclosure. This seemed more appropriate to me to be taken up in the post-implementation review type activity.
Patrick?
The request comes from a study performed by European enforcers.
So by which group?
By European enforcers. It comes from ESMA.
Right. Baz?
Well, I understand the requirement, but from preparer's perspective, I'm not sure if we follow this any requirements and put the notes, the effectiveness or usefulness for the users, I'm not in question. Because we need to communicate what's happening in those segments from business perspective anyway. So I think it's... maybe based on the mistrust or whatever, is that requirement, I guess.
Well, IFRS 8 is a fully converged standard. It has been FAS 131 before, and it has been in use for several years in the U.S., and if there the problem didn't occur, and also from the enforcer side didn't occur, then I don't know why the European enforcers have so many problems with it now that it's in IFRS.
I think Patrick's going to tell you.
Well, I should let Janet speak on this, but maybe there's no problem in the US because there's only one enforcer, and because this enforcer has its own rules and communicates on the rules it applies, and we don't. So we have a different situation.
Guido?
Well, I would also support the view that we should not add another disclosure requirement here, but, you know, I think the request was made to include some more pressure on the preparers, you know, in describing why they have put together some operating segments into reporting segments. I don't think that's the right way to go. I think maybe what should be addressed are the criteria for putting together operating segments. It seems to me that the people think they are not clear enough, so there's too much leeway, and we just, you know, the disclosure requirement seems to be a misuse issue, and maybe we shouldn't look at the new disclosure, but maybe we should look at the criteria for putting together operating segments.
Staff analysis seemed to indicate to me that they didn't think that there was any need to change the wording in the standard for the aggregation. So this seems to be, from what everybody else is saying, more of an application issue, not a standards or an interpretive issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, if those criteria are, and I'm not saying they are not, if they are clear enough, I don't see any need for a disclosure then. Because if they are clear enough, everybody knows or should know how these segments are aggregated.
Peggy?
Just from a preparer perspective, I can tell you from firsthand experience that this is, when it comes to the reportable units that and determining them, the accounting firms are very vigilant over looking at just how companies come up with that, and making sure that people have not aggregated too much or too little. It's something that they pay particular attention to.
Ruth?
It was just a quick question for Patrick. In the circumstances where the regulators or the enforcers have concerns, do you have the authority or the power to request or require that information from the company? Can you directly ask them and say, how have you done this as part of your enforcement?
The problem is that in Europe, enforcers have different powers depending on their local jurisdiction. So in some countries, enforcers will have this ability to require the information, the additional information, but in other countries, this will not be the case.
Scott?
Burnt asked earlier about whether this has been a problem in the U.S., so I have some experience with 131 on three or four sides of the of dealing with the issue. This and every other possible problem with 131 has come up in the U.S., there's no question. Compliance, I think, is still, I would say, fairly poor, even after 10 years. But the way it's dealt with, I think, is exactly what Patrick suggested. If the SEC has a question, they ask it, they get the information, the SEC does. And at times, the SEC, I believe, has asked companies to disclose it when they felt the basis for the analysis was important to users. So they wouldn't ask for the disclosure, I hope, just to help themselves do the job. But if they felt that investors would have expected the analysis to be done one way, but the company actually did it a different way, then the SEC would ask the company to disclose that. And I think in that regard, when the SEC asks for that additional disclosure, it's more along the lines of IAS-1 that you need to disclose whatever information is necessary to make things understandable. And I would say that rather than amend IFRS 8 to add a requirement to always have this disclosure, we might, in an agenda decision, point out that if that information would be important to users, then it ought to be disclosed by IAS-1. That's I think, about the best we can do right now as standard setters without the users, without believing that users need this information to help in their analysis. I don't think we ought to require disclosure to help regulators, despite the fact that I have a background as a regulator. I think we need to be focused on what users need.
Scott, can I just ask you a follow-up question on that? Because this is really a two-part paper. and the staff had focused on disclosure as being the way, in effect, of solving both parts. But were the problems for whichever companies you were aware of in the US in applying 131, were the problems in the way that they inappropriately aggregated segments, or was it something to do with the determination of what information was provided to the chief operating decision maker and who that person was?
Yes. Both.
Both.
Yes. And this is not in the past only, by the way. I mean, this continues to be an issue. If you look at SEC, you know, sort of hot topic speeches, I don't think they've had to change the segment slides in the last 10 years. it continues to be an issue. And I tell my clients these days when they call and say, you know, the SEC is asking questions about our segments, but we only have one reportable segment. I seriously doubt that's the case.
They probably only have one cash-generating unit for impairments.
That's right. And, you know, of course, they give a bunch of information to the CEO, but he doesn't use it, really, because CEOs always get lots of information they don't use. But it's a continuing problem, but it is an application problem. It isn't something that I would go the disclosure route. I mean, if we're looking at putting in disclosures that are meant to ensure compliance with the standard, that seems to me a poor framework for disclosure. I would think that the framework for disclosure should be the information the users need to understand the financials rather than information that helps us know whether people applied the standard correctly. If they didn't apply the standard correctly, there's an error in the financial statements. Disclosure doesn't fix it.
Okay. Janet, do you want to comment on any?
Yes, I'd just like to say that we would be supportive of the disclosures of management judgment. I wouldn't say that we have, you know, a strong position on it, but we could support something like this.
Ruth?
Just as a suggestion, my recollection is that when IFRS 8 was finally approved after much consternation in Europe and the European Parliament, the Parliament directed the ISB, I think it was a direction, to do a post-implementation review to see if the concerns that were raised by users at the time did in fact come to pass. So presumably that time must be coming where the IFRS 8 post-implementation review
right now.
is required. So couldn't we add this to the board, to give it to the board to say this is one of the issues that has been identified by enforcers and ask the board to consider that as part of their post-implementation review?
On that point, there's a couple of reviews that are happening. I think the Parliament directed the Commission to report back to the Parliament on the introduction of IFRS 8 and the implementation of it, rather than directing the board. But the board has committed and has now included in its constitution that it will perform post-implementation reviews after 2 years of implementation of new standards or major amendments. So the Commission itself is charged with doing a post-implementation review. In addition to that, we will be doing our own post-implementation review as well. The ISB's post-implementation review will be starting later this year, because by then we'll have had 2 years of implementation of IFRS 8 on a sort of global basis, taking into consideration sort of June year ends and that sort of thing. And so, yes, we could certainly, and I think we would expect to consider this issue as part of that.
Peggy?
In issue two in the paper, they talk about the CODM's focus. Is it strategic? Is it operational? Should it be more of one or the other? And as I was talking to Denise the other day, I was explaining to her what I have seen is I don't know how you can separate it, quite honestly, because usually whoever is that person is getting, say, operational data, looking at actual performance of, say, a particular segment of a business, And usually once a year, there's an annual budget process that happens. And at that time, then they review the results from the prior year, how you did, and then also look at your budget, then your projections for the year going forward. But also, usually you have a 3 to 5 year strategic plan that gets presented at the same time. So I'm not sure I agree with this comment, and I don't think it makes sense in the real world.
No, unfortunately, I've been made aware that in the real world there are some that have used the strategic aspect of it to say that, in fact, it's only the board of directors of an entity that have that responsibility, and therefore it's only the information that goes to the board. The board typically comprising of a minority of executives and a majority of non-executives, some of whom are completely independent non-executives. And yet the language of IFRS 8 always talks about management or executive decisions. Doesn't include any suggestion at all that non-executives are part of that process. So at that higher level, what ultimately goes to the board is what ultimately is going to be published outside. It becomes a sort of a vicious circle. The less information you want to disclose, the less information you have to, because you're not giving more detailed information, operational information, to the non-executives. It really is an unfortunate situation. Guido?
Well, I agree that we should make the board aware of this issue, but listening to Scott, I think coming back to what I said before, it's not a disclosure issue. Maybe it's an issue of the aggregation criteria. That's what I've heard Scott has said, and also the definition of the CODM. It's not a disclosure issue.
Scott?
What you just described, Bob, is interesting to me. In my experience, which of course is mostly applying this under US GAAP, I haven't had anybody make the argument that the board of directors is the chief operating decision maker. Typically the discussion is whether the chief operating decision maker is the CEO or maybe the COO. And then there's the issue of what information the CODM uses.
Perhaps in the U.S. you don't have the same concern with stewardship that seems to prevail in some countries around the world.
Well, and if there's actually an issue that some are suggesting that the chief operating decision maker is the board, that may be a different issue. I could see an annual improvement if we think that's a problem to possibly clarify that, the chief operating decision maker is a full-time or a group of full-time members of management. It's not, not the board of directors.
Which is what the staff thinks it says at the moment.
Yes, well, that's why I think it never occurred to me that somebody might be looking that way. That might be a more interesting issue to discuss for a potential annual improvement, is clarifying that the CODM is not the board of directors. It's something below that.
Patrick?
Just to confirm that in Europe, in several countries, we have observed that the CODM is identified as the board of directors or an equivalent body, including non-executive directors.
Apparently, Ruth hasn't seen that.
Well, she's Australian.
Yeah, but I'm working in
London. I thought you worked in the ivory tower. Right. The overwhelming view of the committee is that this is not an issue that should be resolved by disclosure. As I understand, Denise, it was an issue that was submitted to the board, perhaps in anticipation of this post-implementation review. Mm-hmm. And I gather the board, because it's overworked at the moment, have asked the IFRIC, comprising all of these people with vast practical experience, to give their input back to the board. So I think the input that you can, I presume you will take back to the board on this, is summed up that the committee's view is that this is not an issue that could be best resolved through introducing additional disclosures, although some of the official observers here feel that disclosures would be a step in the right direction, would be helpful to them, but it's a question of compliance or application and possibly a misunderstanding about the function of the CODM. the staff didn't ask you the question, so maybe this is a little unfair if you're not prepared for it, but whether or not you would think that there is an issue that could go to annual improvements, to clarify, in fact, that the CODM is, I think your words were, a full-time or group of full-time management or executive people. But that's sort of a sense that they were. Yeah, it is not the board that comprises non-executives. It's a group that excludes non-executives because they're involved in operating decisions. Not asking you to formally comment on that, but if you have any thoughts and views, it's something that we could take back to the board and report to them. Does anybody have any comments on that? Is that something that you think might be worth pursuing? Guido?
So the issue is then only to clarify that non-executive directors cannot be chief operating decision makers. Is that the issue?
Whether you think that we need to make an annual improvement to say that more clearly than the standard says at the moment?
Well, I'm just thinking about the situation in Germany. We have a supervisory board with a non-executive sitting there, and we have a management board, and you still can have the management board then being the chief operating decision maker, which from my
point of view, the management board has people who are members of management.
Yeah. So
that's okay.
I was just worrying that we say, well, no, this management board cannot be the chief operating decision maker. That's not what we are saying, right?
No. Andrew?
Just an observation, really. I think before we went down that route, I think we ought to do a bit more research, because I think as a matter of fact, that in many instances, the board, a combination of executives and non-executives, is identified as the CODM. So if we're going to overturn that, we ought to understand why and do a little bit more research. But I don't think yours was a firm proposal to go down that route.
No. It just so if we can report some views back to the board. Ruth?
Just quickly having a look at paragraph 7. And maybe it's just the wording in paragraph 7, but it does say... often the chief operating decision maker of an entity is its chief executive officer or chief operating officer, but for example it may be a group of executive directors or others. So it does say they're executive, but I think it's probably not strong enough because it's got the word often there, so people could argue, well, in my case I can use non-executive director, so it might be worth pursuing a clarification of that.
And it also says others.
Yeah. But then again, we would need presumably to do that together with an amendment to the U.S. standard if we want to keep them converged.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Although it doesn't appear to be a problem in the U.S. I think there were certainly calls that I remember at the time. I can't remember specifically if 131 has the same words to define what the chief operating decision maker is. But following exposure, there were many calls that came to give a more definition as to what that person was, because it wasn't a term that was commonly in use. Scott?
But if it turns out that there is some diversity and that some believe that a group of outside directors in conjunction with executive directors is somehow the chief operating decision maker, I think we ought to explore clarifying that. And I think you're right. In the U.S., I've actually never heard anyone make the case that it's the full board of directors that is the CODM. I think the words are the same, but I can't be certain. But it's always which member or group of members of management. It's the discussion is never extended to outside directors.
Andrew?
I was just thinking of something like an investment trust, which all the managing is done by managers and the board. I mean, they may only have one segment anyway, to be honest, but the board is largely non-executive directors. There's more non-execs than there are execs, so I think we need to have a look at it. But
who takes the decisions about the operation of that investment trust? Are there any operating decisions? I mean, you,
well, the investment manager as the investment manager, but the investment manager's actions are approved or whatever by the board.
Mm-hmm. Well, as they are in many cases, but that's a stretch-up argument. But unless it's an SPE on autopilot, somebody has to take a decision about how the place runs. Final word, Guido?
I don't think that the real issue here is whether and what group and maybe a single person makes the decisions. That might differ from country to country because, for instance, in Germany, the management board, there is no CEO who can make the decision. It has to be made in agreement. That's corporate governance in Germany. So I think the problem is, and that's been written in the submission as I understand it, is that people are arguing there's one group or one person that makes the strategic decisions, another one who makes the operating decisions. And I think the concern is that you're going up and up and up and up in the pyramid, and at the end of the day, you are just providing very few information that is presented to maybe just a very small group of people. I think that's a problem, and I think the reason why people are having this problem is to understand what does operating decisions mean. Is it, my understanding was I'm allocating resources to a segment and I'm checking what the operating results are. So it's more like a return on capital employed. And that's, I think, something that one person or one group of person normally does. Because if I'm providing resources, I want to see what the return is. And other people say, no, this operating things are more like, you know, how many products did I produce this month and so on and so on. It might then be that you have two different groups of persons or two different persons making the resource of allocation decision and the operating review. And I guess that's the heart of the problem here. It's not what group is at the end of the day. Is it one person or many persons?
Yeah. And Guido, that's exactly the one of the points that we were drawing out in issue two of this paper, in particularly in paragraph 18, identifying the dual function of what we see as being defined at the CODM. There's the resource allocation function, so perhaps more of a strategic level, but also the assessing performance part of the role of the CODM. And as you say, it may be that in some organizational structures, you have one person doing one part of that role and a different person doing the other part of that role. And our view, our staff view, is that both of those would be counted as together as the CODM. And so the information that is provided to both of those would be the information that would qualify for disclosure under IFRS 8. If they were provided with different information, then all of that would be required for disclosure.
Okay. I think, Denise, we've given you a fair bit of commentary for you to prepare a note to go back to the board. I suggest we don't publish a decision on whether we take this any further forward or not, because it was a request by the board for us to consider it. So if we go back with this collection of views, explain to the board, and then ask the board if it wants us to do anything else, or if the board itself is going to take this up in its post-implementation review. I'll just make one personal observation at the end, which is that I think we've all made this much harder, and I don't mean we, the committee, but the community. We've made this much harder than it should be, because the objective of moving to IFRS 8 was to report segment information through the eyes of management, and that's the way that the management looks at the business. And we've now become obsessed with defining specific words and terms instead of actually looking at what information is needed to run the business. And that's fairly simple. But unfortunately, on the other side, there's also the tendency of some preparers, but clearly Peggy is not a part of that, and neither is Kaz nor any of our other preparers in the room, but there's a tendency to report less detailed information to the outside world, and therefore it creates these artificial definitions, resulting in a lack of information and a lack of adequate information to the investors. I personally think that better segment information, rather than more disclosure about the assumptions of aggregating the segments, is what we should be aiming for and what we should try and get through. So if there is something that we collectively or individually can do to support the investment community in getting the information that they need through the regulators, then let's discuss that offline as well. All right. Denise, anything else you want from the committee on this topic? Until next time.
Until next time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Right. And in case you think I've forgotten about item 9, we'll get back to it now. Without Michael's permission, I was actually saving this because something that Peggy had mentioned to me yesterday and something that some commentators from the outside have raised is, why do we spend such a lot of time talking about technical issues if it's clear that something is not going to go on the agenda, the DOA, dead on arrival approach? So here is a topic which says we've got a problem, and IS-31 doesn't address it, but IFRS-11 does. So if we were to do something to solve the IS-31 problem, by the time it became effective, IFRS-11 would also be effective. So should we not discuss this paper at all and just say we won't take it onto the agenda because the board has a current project which it completed last week? What do you think, Peggy? You'd like to talk about it?
I would say this would be one that I would pass.
So, Thomas, do we say goodbye? Thank you. Just bear in mind that